This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, June 2, 2003. I'm Amma Bouadi at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. The Federal Communications Commission voted today to weaken media consolidation laws. Bush and Chirac meet for the first time since the US-led campaign into Iraq. And we look at how the Supreme Court's ruling on affirmative action could change the face of university admissions. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. According to The Guardian, a document known as the Waldorf Transcripts is being circulated in European capitals. The transcripts detail a conversation between British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and Secretary of State Colin Powell, in which they express serious doubts about the reliability of intelligence on Iraq's banned weapons program. This as President Bush heads to Egypt for the first in a series of meetings with Arab leaders. Ula Ferawati has more on the upcoming summit.
An Arab-American summit is to be held Tuesday in Egypt's Red Sea port of Sharm el-Sheikh, bringing together the leaders of Egypt, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Bahrain, in addition to Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. The summit will address the Middle East peace process and ways and mechanisms to implement the U.S.-backed roadmap. On the summit's agenda is also discussing the situation in Iraq, the war on terror, and economic cooperation between the U.S. and Arab nations in light of President Bush's proposal of a free trade zone in the Middle East in 10 years. In Amman, Jordan, this is Ola Farawati for Free Speech Radio News.
In Zimbabwe, police used live ammunition and tear gas to disperse crowds that began a week of anti-Mugabe protests today. Naeem Jenner reports.
The mass action was called by the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC. The MDC hopes to intensify the protests until Mugabe steps down from power. The Zimbabwe High Court banned the protests, and police and the army were out in force, clamping down on demonstrators. Foreign journalists are banned in Zimbabwe, but there have been a number of reports coming out of the country today describing how people were attacked, made to lie on the streets, beaten up with batons, and even shot at. Earlier today, MDC leader Morgan Tsvangirai was arrested. He was later charged with contempt of court and released. Many MDC activists, including six members of parliament, have been arrested in various parts of the country. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, was completely shut down today. All businesses in the city heeded the call to remain closed. Many observers view this week as a possible turning point in Zimbabwe's history. If the protests succeed, Mugabe could be forced to quit. If not, he will be emboldened to hold on even longer. Zimbabwe is already facing a major economic crisis with shortages of food and fuel and rising unemployment. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Naeem Jenner in Johannesburg.
Burmese authorities turned away students from universities today and delayed the reopening of primary and high schools, suspending classes just days after they detained pro-democracy leader and Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi and closed almost 100 of the National League for Democracy's offices nationwide. Suu Kyi's whereabouts were not known, but a junta official says that she is in a government guest house in Yangon. Aung Din is a former political prisoner in Burma and currently serves as the Director of Policy and Strategy at the Free Burma Coalition. He says this crackdown is a serious attempt to eliminate the democracy movement in Burma.
This incident proved that the military regime has no intention to make a national reconciliation. They have no sincerity to go back to the barracks. They have no sincerity to hand over the power to the people of Burma. So this is a serious warning to international community to help the strong and decisive collective pressure to remove the Burmese military regime.
The crackdown on Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy party follows a violent clash Friday between her supporters and thousands of pro-government protesters. NLD phone lines have been cut and casualty figures are unconfirmed. Burmese officials say four people died and 50 were injured. Pro-democracy groups say 70 people were killed and many more injured. Habitat for Humanity is opening a theme park designed to give tourists a look at the world's worst slums. Jack Hickey reports from Atlanta.
Visitors to the new theme park will experience directly the dire difficulty of the home life of half of humanity. Habitat guests will also learn about the origins of such squalid misery and a bit about how improvement is possible. Officials here estimate as many as 70,000 visits a year. Carol Gregory, Habitat's regional training manager, speaks about the purpose and potential of this new development.
We all need to be aware that there is poverty around the world. The path through the Global Village and Discovery Center actually starts out with examples of poverty housing that we have actually helped to eliminate. The houses will be examples of houses that we've built in countries such as Guatemala, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which was formerly Zaire. We've had a presence there for a good number of years.
From Atlanta, this is Jack Hickey for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The Federal Communications Commission today approved sweeping new rules by 3-2 that will weaken media consolidation rules, despite fears about reducing the diversity of viewpoints as expressed at town hall meetings and protests across the country. This vote also lifted a ban that prevents a company from owning both a newspaper and a television or radio station, except in the smallest markets. James Collin reports from Washington, D.C.
The 3-2 vote cast along party lines has weakened decades-old rules restricting mass media ownership, spurring fear from many small companies that major industry mergers and acquisitions will likely result. Jonathan Adelson, an FCC commissioner, voted against the changes and said that the media landscape would be damaged for decades to come. Michael Powell, chairman of the FCC.
Retaining the rule against networks merging, tightening the limits on radio ownership, and modifying rather than eliminating the remaining rules are modest, albeit very significant, changes.
John Schwartz, president and founder of Free Speech TV, has been following media ownership rules since the early 70s. He says that the administration's interests are the driving force behind the FCC's decision.
This is part of an ideological shift which is being engineered by Republicans because they believe that, generally speaking, large media companies are going to be friendly.
Schwartz found the FCC's position appalling.
They take rules that were already loose and had already allowed many changes that are inimical to these values, and they made them worse. There is very serious intellectual problems with what just occurred. I don't even know in some ways how these can be enunciated with a straight face.
Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan says that these changes are not only dangerous, but, quote, dumb.
Areas of the internet where people get their news are owned by the same companies that own the broadcast stations. The top 50 channels on cable television, 90% of them owned by the same companies that own the broadcast station. Many stations and many different voices coming from one ventriloquist. I mean, that's the problem here.
Standing outside of the FCC building, the Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition and members of Code Pink protested the Republican-controlled commission's vote. Senator Dorgan, accompanied by other members of Congress, will seek a legislative veto to block the FCC's decision. The Senate Commerce Committee will meet on Wednesday to discuss the ruling and also to reauthorize the FCC's funding. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm James Cullum.
Today, at the G8 summit held in Evian in France, the 8 leaders pledged to widen and intensify the fight against what they identify as international terrorism in a bid to avoid a repeat of the recent attacks in Morocco and Saudi Arabia. This, as a document reported by The Guardian, known as the Waldorf Transcripts, detailing a conversation between British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw and US Secretary of State Colin Powell, in which both men expressed doubt that the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is circulated amongst European capitals. The existence of these transcripts has not affected the relationship between President Bush and French President Jacques Chirac, which also continue to take center stage at the G8 summit. Their first meeting since the US-led invasion of Iraq was described by Agence France-Presse as cordial, with President Bush stating, quote, "There is no question where Jacques Chirac stood, and I made it clear where I stood. That is why I can say we have good relations, because we are able to be very honest with each other." They failed, however, to address the issue of suspending subsidies on farm exports to Africa. African leaders observing the summit slammed the major powers' record on debt relief. Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo said they believed relief was coming too slowly and too selectively. All this whilst reports from Agence France-Presse state that as many as 200,000 activists demonstrated near the summit meeting. Although the majority of protest was non-violent, the minority that did clash with police made front pages. Yvonne Zimmerman reports from Lausanne in France.
On Sunday, when the G8 summit was inaugurated, demonstrations and blockades were carried through in various places. From early in the morning, protesters blocked the motorway between Geneva and Lausanne. More than 100,000 people marched towards the border between Switzerland and France. They started a demo in French en masse and Swiss Geneva and met on the border. Although there were difficulties for protesters in reaching the summit site in Evian, opponents of neoliberal politics have built up resistance camps and held protests in the nearby village en masse as well as in the Swiss towns of Geneva and Lausanne. They criticise that the G8 wants to govern globally without legitimisation and takes decisions within a non-democratic framework. Fatih Shamki, who came especially from Tunisia to participate in the protest, explained that his country has no future with the politics of structural adjustments of the foreign debt.
Aujourd'hui en Tunisie, nous n'avons plus d'avenir sous...
He said that the debt has to be cancelled totally and that people have to take their future into their own hands. The debt was one of the main topics of the social forum of the region that took place over the past days. Carmen Gass, an Argentinian woman living in Switzerland and one of the main organisers of the forum, explained that the People's Tribunal on the debt took place with a lot of participation. Carmen said that there have been many debates and discussions with a broad participation from third world countries. All protests against the G8 summit took place under the surveillance of more than 30,000 policemen and soldiers. In Lausanne, roadblocks met with heavy police repression. More than 400 protesters got arrested and various injured by rubber bullets and tear gas canisters. A British activist, who had abseiled himself from a bridge to block the motorway, fell down 20 metres during a police intervention and got heavily injured. Paul from the legal team explains.
There were two people hanging on a bridge, and the police came, and what happened is that one guy fell from the bridge during the police intervention. At first, the police said the guy fell when he was just trying to do the blockade, and after a few hours, the police recognized that it was a policeman who cut the rope.
On Sunday evening, there were more confrontations between protesters and policemen in Geneva and the Swiss capital, Bern. A cultural centre in Geneva, where an office for independent media was based, got raided and people arrested. Protesters said that in spite of the difficulties in reaching Evian and in spite of the climate of fear that had been created before the summit, an opposition to the G8 had been shown over the weekend. They made clear that resistance against global governance that is being imposed on the peoples on the planet will also have to be shown in the future. Yvonne Zimmerman in Lausanne, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Statistics of big favours done by Pakistan for the United States during its Afghan war was up on the US Central Command website. After a visit to Pakistan by Richard Armitage, the data was removed from the website, and Armitage's mission to get India's Rashtriya Rifles for Iraqi reconstruction was put on hold by the Indian government. Vinod K. Juz has this update from South Asia.
The statistics of the enormous extent of Pakistani assistance U.S. received was recently put on the U.S. Central Command military website. This was an embarrassing e-thanking for Pakistan President Musharraf and handy ammunition for the anti-American right-wing religious forces in Pakistan. After Armitage's visit, the statistics is off the web loop. Ashutosh Mishra is a Pakistan expert with Indian Defence and Strategic Analysis, the research body for India's Defence Ministry and Indian Intelligence Forces.
The larger reason behind this has been, you know, Musharraf must have been, you know, quite embarrassed in convincing the right-wing parties who have been taking printouts of all these information and telling him that we have, you know, very reliable information how you have sold out the country to the United States. So that is where, you know, it must have been very difficult for Musharraf to convince his local constituency and the jihadis. That's why they must have taken it out.
The missing website page had the details like, on an average, 400,000 litres of fuel was provided by Pakistan to the US every day. As many as 57,800 US military sorties were generated from Pakistan's airspace or its soil. Islamabad handed over 5 air bases. Pakistan's Navy extended landing facilities to US warships at Pasni and curtailed its own operations to accommodate and facilitate U.S. naval operations. The website also quoted U.S. Marine Corps Gazette of June 2002, describing the joint naval operation as the largest amphibious operations in size, duration, and depth that the Marine Corps has conducted since the Korean War. Pakistan fulfilled 2008 of the 2,160 requests of different nature made by the U.S., while the remaining 152 are listed as action in process. Pakistan's already fragile economy suffered an estimated loss of over $10 billion because of the help provided to the U.S.-led coalition forces. On the other side of the border, it is the story of India backing out from its assurance.
America is like a poisonous snake. In my opinion, when they come and ask for military help, we should not give it to them. Why should we? India should not send its soldiers to Iraq at any cost.
That was Narayanan, a supplier in a canteen in Delhi, demanding not to send Indian troops to Iraq. A fortnight back, Armitage managed to wind up his South Asia tour by making India agree for sending its troops to Iraq for reconstruction. But Armitage's selection of Rashtriya Rifles, a paramilitary force notorious for human rights violation in Kashmir, was criticized from some sections of Indian intelligentsia. Opposition parties raised this question of sending Indian troops when the Indian parliament had already passed a resolution asking US and UK forces to withdraw from Iraq. India's defense advisor, Brijesh Misra, asked Jewish community in Washington last month and talked about a Tel Aviv-Washington-New Delhi-Axis alliance. Research scholars like Siya Pramod of School of International Relations thinks India's ruling Hindu right-wing conservative party wants to see a triangular alliance of Israel, United States, and India.
And sending troops to Iraq as a response gives a clear indication of India, US, and Israel having a common interest of right-wing conservative coalition. So it has to be rejected, it has to be opposed, and it is very illegitimate.
Indian cabinet is still contemplating over whether India should wait till it gets a formal UN invitation or should take up Armitage's offer. If India finally decides to send its troops to work under US Central Command and General Tommy Franks, it gives a clear signal of Indo-US joint military cooperation in the years to come. From New Delhi in India, I am Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Later this month, the US Supreme Court is scheduled to make a ruling on what observers say is one of the most important legal challenges since 1978, the admissions policy at the University of Michigan. Its ruling on race diversity and affirmative action could dictate how universities consider applicants' race for admissions. Meanwhile, advocates for affirmative action gathered for a conference in New York to prepare for the battle that lies ahead. Simba Rousseau files this report from New York.
The 5th National Conference of the New Civil Rights Movement, held over the weekend, included a rally, various workshops, and a mock press conference. The event was organized by the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action and Integration and Fight for Equality by Any Means Necessary. According to University of Michigan defendant Agnes Aloba, the purpose of the conference was to develop a network of civil rights leaders from around the country in preparation of the Michigan case decision.
Affirmative action was implemented at the University of Michigan and similar colleges coming out of massive student struggle. It took black students standing with white students on this campus demanding that there be an increase in black and minority students.
Three white applicants sued the university in 1997, alleging that the institution denied them admission because it operated on a quota system for minorities. In 2001, a U.S. district court judge ruled that the use of race as a factor in the university's admission was unconstitutional. The university has appealed the decision.
The Michigan Law School and the University of Michigan may maintain its elitist, as it refers to it, selection process without regard to race, or it may achieve the racial diversity it seeks with race-neutral compromises in its admission standards.
Representing the Bush administration and the University of Michigan, Solicitor General Theodore B. Olson defends the right of colorblindness approaches for university and military admission.
But the one thing that it may not do is compromise its admission standards or change its admission requirements for one race and not another. That is forbidden by the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution.
In 1998, voters passed Proposition 209, which ended affirmative action, resulting in a decline in minority populations at universities like UC Berkeley. Like California, the state of Texas and Florida have also followed suit. They run on a point system, which offers admissions to the top 10% of each graduating class. National leader Tanya Troy says that they are determined to keep institutions of higher education integrated.
This is an issue of whether or not young Black, Latino, Native American, and other minority students have access to the institutions, educational institutions of this country, that integration itself cannot be achieved by things like the percentage plans that are in place in California and in Texas. We know that those plans are based on the fact that there is segregation in housing.
The university argues that its programs, which are similar to admission policies at many other selective institutions, are designed to create diversity in its student population. It says that the Supreme Court in 1978 Bach case endorsed this rationale. In the Bach case, the court ruled that universities could not set fixed numerical quotas for minority admissions to remedy past discriminations. Addressing lawyers at a recent court hearing, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor reiterated the court's dedication to racial equality.
You're speaking in absolutes, and it isn't quite that. I think we have given recognition to the use of race in a variety of settings.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor is being viewed as a swing vote on an evenly divided court. Not only will the court's decision affect the University of Michigan, but all sectors of education and business as well. A ruling on the court's decision is scheduled this summer, and organizers say they will be prepared to fight to the end. For Free Speech Radio News in New York, I'm Simba Russo.
The Bush administration is currently attempting to pass regulations that could radically change the Fair Labor Standards Act overtime protections. Sarah Turner reports.
Continuing the attack on worker protections, the Bush administration's newest proposal would eliminate overtime pay for millions of workers. Currently, the Fair Labor Standards Act requires employers to pay overtime to employees who work over 40 hours per week. While most workers are eligible to receive overtime pay, currently, there are narrowly drawn exemptions for administrative, professional, and executive employees. The Department of Labor's proposed new regulations would make it much easier for employers to deny overtime pay to workers. Greg McGillivary is the union chair of the American Bar Association's Committee on FLS legislation and believes the proposed changes will usher in a wave of lawsuits.
There's an exemption for administrative workers, and the administration has proposed to eliminate the general test, which is you have to be considered an administrative worker, you have to exercise independent judgment with regard to matters of significance to the business. And that's been interpreted to mean that the worker bees in the company cannot be exempt as administrators. The administration is proposing to remove that with a test called if you occupy a position of responsibility.
This wording is so ambiguous that it could include nearly everyone. McGillivary states his opinion on the motives behind the proposed changes at the Department of Labor.
There's been a number of high-profile lawsuits in California where workers have won millions of dollars, which is money that they were owed and was taken from them, incidentally. And the companies have raised a level of hysteria about that. So the Bush administration is proposing these regulations to pay off the companies.
David Cohen, assistant to the president of the Department of Professional Employees, believes that almost all of the 4 million professional, technical, and administrative workers they represent will lose their overtime pay. This is in part due to a completely new super exemption, disqualifying anyone earning over $65,000 per year, including benefits, from overtime protections.
One of the purposes that premium pay for overtime, time and a half for overtime work, serves is to encourage employers not to make people work overtime. Well, politicians who talk about family values need to leave people a little time with their families to transmit those values.
Several labor unions, including the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers, have been waging an intense political campaign to protect the rights of unionized and non-union workers. Matt Biggs, legislative and political director for the IFPTE, has been working hard to lobby against the proposed regulations. But he argues that the Bush administration is trying to sneak the changes through without the public's knowledge.
The Department of Labor is doing it through regulation so they don't have to take it to Congress, where they'll have, I think, in my opinion, a difficult time getting such a proposal through.
Those working to halt the proposed changes to overtime pay believe that the only way to stop these cuts is if the public finds out what's being planned and takes immediate action.
This is not a Republican or Democrat issue. This is a pay cut for Americans, and this is being put forth by the Bush administration. In fact, this proposed regulation was written for and by corporate America.
The Department of Labor is accepting comments until June 30th, after which time they can implement any changes. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner, reporting from Washington, D.C.
On May 25, four peace activists calling themselves the Riverside Plowshares threw their own blood and hammered on the missile launch hatches of the deck of the guided missile cruiser USS Philippine Sea as dozens of civilians were touring the ship in a New York harbor. In a surprising twist from the dozens of previous Plowshares actions against weapons of mass destruction, the four were released after a few hours in custody and not charged. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven, Connecticut, where she spoke with the Plowshare activists.
The USS Philippine Sea was the first U.S. Navy vessel to launch missiles at Afghanistan in the war in 2001. The activists boarded the ship during a public tour as part of Fleet Week in New York Harbor. They are Brian Buckley of Virginia, Mark Colville of Connecticut, Joan Gregory of New York, and Sister Susan Clarkson of Britain. All are members of Catholic worker communities, which espouse nonviolent direct action against militarism in support of the poor. Speaking yesterday from his home in New Haven, Colville described the action.
As soon as we started pouring the blood, these sailors backed away and backed the rest of the crowd away. And so they basically left us alone.
Colville says for several minutes, the four prayed and held up photos of dead and wounded Iraqis from the U.S. and British-led military campaign into Iraq. And when the sailors told others on the tour to ignore the protesters,
Joan started addressing the people directly and saying, "No, you can't ignore us." Pointing to the pictures, she said, "This is what these weapons do."
Colville says they were arrested and escorted off the ship to booze from most of the visitors on board. Plowshares peace actions date back to 1980. Since then, more than 150 people have participated in more than 70 actions in several countries that have targeted a range of weapons and delivery systems. It appears that this is the first Plowshares action in the U.S. in which participants were not charged with a crime. A spokeswoman for the New York Police Department told Free Speech Radio News that since no charges were filed, she has no information on the incident. Colville says there seemed to be a jurisdictional question between the NYPD and federal authorities since the incident took place on a ship under control of the Pentagon. After sitting handcuffed in a van for 3 hours, they were released when both jurisdictions declined to press charges. But Stephen Cobesa, a longtime peace activist from New Haven, says he doubts the four activists were released on a technicality.
To silence them is, I think, one choice that they've made in this case. There's a deliberate decision just to erase public notice and to try to make it invisible.
Colville says the goal of the actions is to take responsibility for modern weapons.
To the sailors, it's a video game, you know. And they never see, I underline never, see the results of what they're doing.
There have been several Plowshares actions in Britain, but Susan Clarkson, a nun who works with the poor in London, says she found special meaning in acting with three Americans on U.S. soil as a response to the close cooperation between the U.S. and Britain in the war in Iraq.
Well, this is perhaps to redress the balance a little bit. I would like to work with people who are committed to disarmament here, so that to give a message that it's not all join Britain and the United States joining forces to destroy and to kill, but in our own way we're joining forces to disarm.
Within the peace movement, some have criticized the Plowshares' actions of pouring blood and hammering on weaponry as violent or as too draining on the movement's resources. Others say they raise awareness of the violence inherent in militarism better than other forms of protest. Given the never-ending so-called war against terrorism and the increases in the U.S. military budget, Plowshares' actions will most likely continue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven, Connecticut.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I am Amma Bouadi.